The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article, which comes from the Harvard Health Letter of May 2023, is called Ask the Doctor, by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who is the editor-in-chief. Question. My doctor says he'll no longer be the one responsible for my care if I need to be hospitalized. Instead, hospital doctors will be responsible. Why is that? In the United States, over the past 20 years, a new type of doctor, the hospitalist, has increasingly become responsible for the care of many patients in the hospital. While it's new in the United States, this has been the model for a long time in many other countries. For many years in our practice of primary care internal medicine, whenever our patients were hospitalized, we were the primary care doctors responsible for them, unless they had surgery or needed to be in an intensive care unit. When our patients got sick enough to require hospitalization, they liked having a doctor they knew. But it was increasingly difficult for my colleagues and me to do. It's hard to be in two places at once, in the office seeing patients and also up on the floors of the hospital where some of your patients were. If your patient was having a crisis, you had to be at their bedside, even if your office schedule was full for the next 3 hours. Moreover, while our office practice is in a clinic at the hospital, just an elevator away from the hospitalized patients, many of our colleagues had offices outside the hospital. They were separated from their hospitalized patients by traffic. There was another problem, too. As the amount of medical knowledge grew and the number of new technologies to care for hospitalized patients grew, it was harder for the primary care doctor to keep up. Increasingly, hospitalist doctors who are present in the hospital 24 hours a day take care of hospitalized patients, often in consultation with the patient's primary care doctor. It's not a perfect solution. While the primary care doctor may have known the patient for decades, the hospitalist rarely knows the patient at all. The patient's medical record is often readily available to the hospitalist, but that record can be very thick. Even when the hospitalist has mastered all the detail on the record, it's not the same thing as knowing the human being who has just become their patient. Many young graduating doctors are choosing to be hospitalists, and fewer are choosing to be primary care doctors. In my opinion, the increasing number of hospitalists is a good thing. And there are studies suggesting it's improving the quality and efficiency of hospital care. But I also worry that the future will bring a shortage of primary care doctors, the doctors who know you, who have seen you through thick and thin, whose face you recognize and advice you trust when they arrive at your hospital bed in a moment of crisis. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is entitled, Caregivers, You Deserve a Break. Consider respite care options so you can recharge and remain in your caregiving role. Being a caregiver for a family member, particularly for someone with substantial needs, is a labor of love. Whether you're caring for a spouse, a parent, adult child, grandchild, or another family member, the job has high demands, grueling hours, no pay, little time for yourself, and in some cases, health risks. Meeting a loved one's need can come at the cost of the caregiver's own well-being. While the role can be deeply satisfying, it can also lead to burnout and risks for high blood pressure, fatigue, sleep problems, depression, isolation, significant weight loss or weight gain, and even premature death, says Marie Cloquer, a therapist and geriatric case manager, in the Division of Geriatrics at Harvard Affiliated McLean Hospital. You need a breather now and then to exercise, to go to doctor's appointments, to see friends, or simply recharge, to maintain your equilibrium and have the strength to continue as a caregiver. The way to do that is with respite care. What is respite care? Respite care involves a substitute caregiver giving you a break. It can last for a few hours or a few weeks. Respite care might come from a family member or a friend who volunteers to help out. Or it can come from outside services like adult or child daycare centers, short-term stays in a skilled nursing or memory care facility, professional child care services, or private duty care. A private duty care agency can send someone to be with your loved one up to 24 hours a day. Agencies can provide several types of professionals for adult or pediatric care, depending on your loved one's needs. A registered nurse, a licensed health aide who can provide hands-on physical care, like help with bathing, eating, or using the bathroom. Or a companion who can help with meal preparation, lighthouse work, or transportation. Respite care can be expensive. For example, the national rate for private duty care workers is $26 per hour. It's $12 to $20 for professional child care. A temporary stay at a nursing home might run $200 per day. Many nonprofit groups offer volunteer respite care services, and there are hundreds of organizations, including federal and state governments, the Veterans Administration, and nonprofits like Easter Seals, that offer financial assistance for respite care. The pots of money are often small and restricted, and eligibility requirements vary. Several government and nonprofit organizations can help you find respite care. The primary places to call are your state's Lifespan Respite Coalition, your local area agency on aging, and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for veterans. When you contact an agency, be specific about what you want. These agencies offer a lot of services, and you want to get the right person. Ask for the caregiver coordinator. When you speak to the coordinator, explain that you need a break, and you're looking for respite care and a way to pay for it, suggests Jill Kagan, director of ARCH, National Respite Network and Resource Center. ARCH is a national resource program that can guide you to respite service in your area. Its website is www.archrespite.org. That's ARCHRESPITE. /respite locator. RESPITE. This has information and links for all the agencies that have been mentioned. Having someone substitute for you as a caregiver can feel uncomfortable at first. Three issues often come up, and here are some ways to cope with them. The first issue is concern for your loved one's well-being. Check the caregiver's credentials and spell out what you want them to do. Be clear about your loved one's needs. Ask if the program can accommodate them. How you'll know if caregivers are actually following your instructions, how often you'll hear from them, and how often you can contact them, Cloaker says. For more questions to ask, visit www.health.harvard.edu/RCF. Difficulty breaking the news. You may wonder how to explain respite care to your loved one. Tell them what your goal is for this care. For adult daycare, you could say, you're going to a place with peers who want to meet you and get to know you, where you can do some enjoyable activities together. For private duty care, you could say, I'm bringing in someone who can make sure you're comfortable and find interesting things for you to do while I'm gone. Guilt about leaving. It's normal to feel guilty about getting time to yourself. Consider it an experiment and look at the outcome. Did the benefits of respite care outweigh the costs and feelings of guilt? Cloaker asked. Taking a break can help you restore a sense of who you are and allow you to bring your best self back to your role as a caregiver. Now we're continuing with the Harvard Health Letter of May 2023. And here's an article entitled, Preparing Your Feet for Summer. Strengthening the muscles in your feet and learning about pain relief will help you keep active this summer. Flip-flops, crop tops, and backyard barbecues, they're all signs of summer. Foot pain isn't a welcome part of that picture, but it will be a reality for many people. We often see people develop problems when they wear sandals or go barefoot, or when they increase their activities after being less active, says Dr. Adam Tenford, a sports medicine specialist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehab Hospital. Fortunately, there's time to get your feet ready for the challenges that come with warm, sunny days and increased outdoor activities. It's especially important to be proactive about foot pain if you had a particular foot problem in the past, or a risk factor like obesity, diabetes, or thyroid disease. You may want to visit your foot doctor for a checkup. You can also consider the following steps. First, get the right equipment. This is the time to shop for shoes with the right support for your summer activities. Most flip-flops don't fill the bill. Whether it's playing sports, sightseeing, or standing for long periods, look for shoes with large or open toe boxes that don't crowd the toes. Laces or a back strap to provide stability for the foot, and good arch support. A new trend in foot treatment strengthens the small muscles in the foot core through physical therapy. Just wearing supportive shoes won't make pain go away. A physical therapist trained in foot core strengthening can help you learn to engage the muscles in the feet, which will help to relieve tension in the ligaments. You can watch a video on foot core strengthening that Dr. Tenford and his colleagues published in the Video Journal of Sports Medicine at www.health.harvard.edu/NOMS-HL. Make a gradual change. If you want to wear sandals with less support than your regular shoes, or if you'll soon be walking barefoot on a beach, get your feet ready. Wear slightly less supportive shoes at home, and then shoes with even less support. This will give your feet time to adapt and get stronger. Learn some quick fixes. If foot pain does strike, address it as soon as possible. One thing you can do is hot and cold therapy. Try this with foot baths. Fill one small basin with warm water and another with cool water. Swirl your feet around in the warm water for 10 minutes. That will help to open the blood vessels and promote blood flow, bringing nutrients to sore foot muscles. Then swirl your feet in cool water. That will make the blood vessels narrow and reduce inflammation and swelling. For foot pain and swelling, use a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug in a topical form like diclofenac or Voltaren, which inhibits substances in the body that cause pain and inflammation. If you just have foot pain, try a cream or gel that contains menthol or lidocaine, or both, which interrupt pain signals in the nerves. As with any medication, creams with NSAIDs, That's NSAID. Or lidocaine can cause side effects. So use only a little at a time and get your doctor's okay first. Massaging the feet helps to improve circulation, stimulate muscles, reduce tension, and ease pain. You can get those effects by rolling your feet over a massage ball or foot roller, or try massaging your feet with your hands and a little skin lotion. If you have any circulation problems, talk to your doctor first. Then you might want to seek shockwave therapy. This therapy, which costs about $100 to $250 per session, uses sound and pressure waves to heal injuries in the foot and ankle. It's not covered by insurance, Dr. Ten Ford says, but treatment can help heal injuries and provide long-term pain relief from conditions like plantar fasciitis. And then the article goes on to mention some common foot conditions. One is plantar fasciitis. This condition is marked by sharp arch or heel pain that starts with tiny tears in the plantar fascia, a thick band of tissue that lies at the bottom of the foot and supports the arch. Another is Achilles tendonitis. The Achilles tendon attaches to the heel. It can become irritated and cause pain and swelling in the heel behind your ankle. Then there is sesamoiditis. The sesamoid bones are embedded in a tendon near the big toe. The bones and tendon can become inflamed and cause pain and swelling in the ball of the foot. Then there is bunion irritation. A bunion is a deformity marked by a bump at the base of a misaligned big toe. The joint can become inflamed and painful. Finally, there's arch irritation. People with fallen arches typically have weak tendons of the arch to the foot. Wearing shoes without arch support can cause pain in the arch area or heel. Now here's another article from the Harvard Health Letter, May 2023. It's called, Get More Out of Your Daily Walk. Incorporate balance exercises, weight training, and vigorous activity into your routine. You already go for a walk every day, which is great for overall health. Regular brisk walking helps control the LDL or bad cholesterol, control blood pressure, strengthen muscles, burn calories, and lift mood. Walking can also help to ward off high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. And you can get even more health benefits by adding a few simple upgrades to your daily health. Your daily walk. Improve your balance. Your sense of balance is based in the brain. The brain integrates information from your inner ear organs, vision, and nerve endings, and feelings in the feet and muscle, all the way up to the spine, says Dr. Stephen Rauch, medical director of the Balance and Vestibular Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. To maintain good balance, you need to put it to work regularly. Taking a daily brisk walk is good practice. If walking is easy for you, Dr. Rauch suggests making it a little harder to get even more practice and potentially get better at balancing. For example, during a walk, you could periodically take about 10 steps, walking heel to toe. The narrower your base of support when standing, the trickier it is to maintain your balance. You might also try turning sideways and taking 10 side steps, or keep walking forward but turn your head slowly left and right a few times in a row. If you're walking in a certain direction but turn and look in a different direction or aim your ears in a different direction, you're not giving the usual visual or auditory feedback to the brain, and it challenges your balance, Dr. Rauch says. The more gentle stress we place on our bones, the stronger they'll become. The reason is that exerting force on the bones stimulates them to add cells, which speeds up the process of building bone mass. Weight-bearing exercise is a standard way to strengthen your bones, and walking is a weight-bearing activity. Weightlifting is also a good way to strengthen bones. You can combine the two activities for extra oomph by wearing a weighted vest on your walk. Get one that allows you to adjust the amount of weight you'll carry, like a vest that has removable weights. You can find them for about $40 or more online or at sporting goods stores. How much weight should you carry in the vest? Start with 5 pounds. After 2 weeks, increase to 7.5 pounds. 2 weeks later, move up to 10 pounds. But don't wear the vest if it makes it hard to walk, or if you experience any pain or soreness after wearing it, suggests Vijay Daryanani, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehab Hospital. Make your heart work harder. Walking at a brisk pace is a moderate intensity activity that makes your heart and lungs work harder. The exertion activates changes in your muscles, metabolism, blood vessels, and brain that contribute to improved heart health. Your heart and lungs work even harder and get even more benefit with vigorous activity, the kind that makes it difficult to talk while working out, like playing tennis or jogging. But check with your doctor before starting a program of vigorous activity. One way to make your heart work harder on a walk is by adding arm movements. About 10 minutes into a 30-minute walk, begin raising your arms up and down repeatedly in any way that feels comfortable, like straight out in front of you, above your head, or out to the sides. Try to maintain the arm activity as long as possible, up to 10 minutes. Then continue your walk for another 10 minutes. Another way to make your heart work harder on your walk is by adding high-intensity interval training, which is called HIIT. HIIT involves brief bouts of strenuous exercise. It's associated with equal or greater improvements in blood pressure and blood sugar compared with moderate intensity exercise. Be sure to check with your doctor. During a walk, that would mean periodically breaking into a run for about 30 to 60 seconds. The easier this becomes, the longer the high-intensity intervals can last. Eventually, you may be able to walk for 5 minutes, then run for 5 minutes, alternating the activity for 30 minutes. And now another story from News Briefs from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled Appreciating Golf's Cardiovascular Perks. Golf is jokingly described as a good walk spoiled, but that walk is loaded with cardiovascular health benefits, maybe even more than you'd get from an hour of brisk walking or Nordic walking, suggests a small randomized study published online by British medical journal Open Sport and Exercise Medicine. Researchers asked 25 healthy, experienced golfers, who were men and women aged 65 or older, to complete three different types of exercise within a 5-day period, just one activity per day. The exercises included one 18-hole round of golf on foot, pulling the golf clubs, 1 hour of brisk walking, and 1 hour of Nordic walking, which involves the use of poles. On exercise days, participants ate identical breakfast and snacks, had their blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol measured before and after exercise, and wore activity trackers. All three activities lowered blood pressure and levels of blood sugar and cholesterol. But golf seemed to have slightly more effect on blood sugar and cholesterol. Scientists speculate it's because of the game's long duration, 3 to 4 hours, and the extra energy required to drag heavy clubs around a golf course. In fact, golfing burned more than twice as many calories as the walking activities. Because the study was small, a larger long-term study would be needed to confirm the results. I'm going to briefly read a story from the second opinion in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of April 2023. Question. I've taken Synthroid for years to manage my hypothyroidism. Is it okay to switch to a generic version to save on prescription costs? The treatment for an underactive thyroid gland is known as hypothyroidism is fairly straightforward. You'll likely be prescribed the medication levothyroxine, which is sold as Synthroid and other brand names. This drug replaces the amount of hormone your thyroid can no longer make to restore healthy levels in your body. But this prescription has long been complicated by two questions. Is a generic brand of levothyroxine as effective as brand-named options? Is it okay to switch between generic brands? Experts, including those at the Mayo Clinic, now generally agree that generic levothyroxine works just as well as the brand name version. There's less agreement on the second question. One particular concern, if people are prescribed a generic, their prescription could be filled with a drug from any generic manufacturer. It's thought that formulations made by different manufacturers could lead to different hormone levels in those taking the medication. For this reason, the American Thyroid Association recommends sticking to one brand or manufacturer of levothyroxine. But a recent study of thousands of people taking generic levothyroxine found no significant difference in the percentage of those with normal TSH levels in those who switched generics and those who stuck to the same generic. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.